listening to Wake Up Hollywood with Nikki Kalula and Eddie Pence, right here on LA Talk Radio.
Wake up, Hollywood. This is your host with the most, Nikki Kalula. We're going to jump right into another quarantined edition of Wake Up, Hollywood. And we're going to welcome Sepand from the band Days Between Stations. Say hello, Sepand.
Hello, hello. How's everybody?
So I got to ask you first, where's that name from? What race are you?
I was born in Iran in 1975.
Wow.
And moved to Spain in 81. We immigrated after the revolution, and then to Canada in 1986, and then LA 2001.
That's amazing. You know, I have a good friend who's a musician from Iran, and he was telling me that, you know, you're not allowed to play rock and roll music in Iran. And I know a couple bands that have come from there, and they were like banned from the country because it's illegal to kind of play rock and roll. Is that true, or is it?
That is true. I know with some of the more traditional music, even dancing is not allowed. So it's rather a rigid situation.
Is that because of the religious, like,
it's
connotation? So
They
just believe that rock and roll is the root of all evil.
Yes. That hasn't changed since Elvis's day, huh?
That's crazy.
It's crazy.
It's old traditions. So,
it's really sad. There's actually a huge kind of group on Facebook and Instagram. They reach out and they talk, and you know, I try to do my best to support them. But obviously, you have to watch what you say. You can't. It's free speech on one side and not free speech on the other.
Well, you know, the reason there was a band that came out to L.A. and a friend of mine housed them. He just ended up meeting them. They were looking for their hotel and they couldn't find it. And he knows me. I'm a musician, and he knows how hard it is when you're struggling and touring. And he got to know these guys, and they were telling him how they had to rehearse in secret, and they had to learn their instruments like without any kind of instruction. And so like, they play their instruments in a very unique way because of that. And they said that they'd have to rehearse in like an old abandoned warehouse. And I was like appalled listening to that. I'm like, man, You don't realize how good you have it until you hear a story like that. So
yeah, you're absolutely correct.
Tell me what it was like. Like, you know, you grew up there for a couple of years. Did you feel any of that influence? And is that what made you kind of drawn to music, or was it just the fact that, you know, you were able to follow that creative path?
No one has asked me that in the past 20 years, man.
I only ask the good questions.
that actually hit me. You know, I remember a few things, right? Obviously, you know, we had a lot of family, so those are really fun memories, going to grandma's, cousins coming over, you know. And you're this little kid and you're looking at your giants, your uncles and cousins and stuff. There's a lot of things that affected me. One was the first time I realized my mom was lying to me. I was 4 years old and I was sitting in the car. This is after the revolution. And she pointed at a bunch of guys in green army clothing, right? And she said, you know, those guys over there, if they ever ask you, do you like Khomeini? I want you to say, I love him. Right. I could see the fear in her eyes. And I knew she was lying to me, but I also knew I shouldn't discuss this further, that I should oblige. That stuff really stuck to me. And my dad was helping a lot of friends out. They were hiding in his house along with us, obviously. So a lot of that impacted, you know, and when you come across the ocean to countries like Canada and the United States, you really appreciate what's been said. I was talking to my friend the other day. I said Memorial Day to me is still real because I remember people knocking on doors and checking to see what's going on, you know?
That's wild.
And just imagine how the poor early Americans felt with the British knocking on the doors, you know?
Yeah.
So there's a lot of parallels in that regard.
Well, it's weird that government gets involved with something like art. You know what I mean? It's like art is an expression of emotions. It's like a colorful thing that a lot of people grow from, but I think they see it as anarchy. And I think that's part of it. And then you have the religion, the religious factor, which is like, and a lot of it's related to sex. You know, they just feel like, oh, it's not a good thing, you know, for people to have kind of emotional desires of any kind. So tell me a little bit about that, because that I find that suffocating for any person to have to just like,
it is suffocating,
know, especially for young people. You know, it's like I can't imagine growing up with those kind of restrictions. But
I shouldn't be the proper person to be the statistician on this, but I understand that Iran has a very the median age is, I think, in the mid 30s. So it has a lot of youth. But it's a lot of youth that has lost the ability to dream. So there's a lot of drug problems.
Wow, really?
Yeah. I mean, you're above Afghanistan, so you have all the opium coming down. And, you know, it's and meth. So it breaks your heart. It really, really breaks your heart. And on the other side of the coin, you have guys like the mayor of New York, de Blasio, instead of helping people out, He's pushing lots of money to fund art in the subway stations, as if subway's going to deal with the corona aftermath, right?
Right. Nuts. So tell me.
At you, like it means anything.
Right. Tell me how you got into music, and what was the band or the song or the sound that kind of like made you gravitate towards it?
A lot of it, I have to say, was like soup. Living in Iran, our blues is called sonati, S-O-N-A-T-I, and it's a lot of instruments. Actually, we share it with Pakistan and India. Yeah, India has a sitar, which is 30 strings, and we have the tar, which is 6 strings. So there was a lot of symbiosis. So
is it tuned in fourths, fifths? Well, what is it tuned in?
In fifths.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and so my dad would play sonati, you know, so that was our blues. So what I'm trying to tell you is that although I'm not paying attention to that music and I wasn't really digging it, it still permeated me, you know.
Right.
And then my mom would listen to pop. My mom's 10 years younger than my dad. So in the 80s, she was still young, right? So in Spain, she would listen to a lot of pop. So I got introduced to Depeche Mode and all those cool bands. And then moving to Canada, it was a very heavy rock scene at that time. Canada is still classic rock. This is pre-2000. So, you know, a lot of bands like the Tea Party, a lot of different influences. And being so close to Europe, by 86, 87 to 89, we got a lot of that acid techno from Spain, you know, so that scene was coming over. So it was like a buffet of music. It was just amazing. And I was, how old was I? Smells Like Teen Spirit, which was the most impactful on me. That was 2001. I was 16. So, and I believe you were 14, sir.
Yeah. I was about to say, I was about the same age. You know, like I was heavy into Nirvana. And fun fact, I ended up working at Guitar Center maybe almost 20 years ago, and one day Dave Grohl came in, and I ended up selling him a guitar, and he was the nicest guy, and I like, you know, they kind of tell you, like, don't try to, like, you know, bombard a celebrity if you can, treat him like a customer and be helpful, but I wanted to be a fanboy and just be like, yo, man, I love Nirvana, I love the Foo Fighters, and I love all the stuff you're doing, and, but I was just like, basically talked to him about guitars, and he was super cool, and he bought a Taylor 310. I still remember what he bought.
Nice.
So I think he was buying it as a gift, but yeah, man, Nirvana was a huge influence, I think, on everybody growing up at that time.
I think so. And it was the screaming, it was the angst, it was the rules that were thrown out, right?
Right.
And you would make comments like "God is gay." It was so profound.
Yeah.
And you'd see female singers more than ever on the rock stage, right? You had Kim Gordon from Sonic Youth.
Yeah.
You had the Breeders, you know, and on. So it was a really cool time. And I think what really opened the door was I lived in a little village. I think it's more of a touristy town now. It's known. It's Marbella, Spain. It's right.
Oh, yeah. I know where that is. Yeah.
So in 1986, Queen came, right?
Oh, my God.
85. I must have been 9 or 10. And I remember my parents told me to go to bed. And it was a soccer stadium, which was maybe 20 miles, but I could still hear it. I opened my window, and I heard Queen through my
window. Oh, my God. That's crazy. And I
still got goosebumps, man. You know, it was just like, that's wild. And it had such an influence on us because on our album, again, not to even compare ourselves to Queen.
Right.
We have like a radio friendly song, and we have songs that are just, you know, that usually take time and a bunch of listens if we're lucky. So that was it. So you got a hodgepodge of stuff. And Oscar's got, you know, Mexican background, and you know, he grew up in California in his later years. And he listens to a lot of prog and classical.
That's crazy. And you know what? What's interesting about that is like Queen was a ginormous band in England, right? And, you know, my brother, he spent some time over there, and he brought back the first Queen album. It was like a Queen's Greatest Hits record. And I was listening to them all the time, like in middle school. And nobody was really hip to them here. The only time anybody, like when I'd reference them, I'd be like, oh, you know, when the NBA playoffs are playing, you hear "We Will Rock You," that's Queen. You know, yeah. That's how I would explain it to people. But yeah, man, that band is like one of the most influential. Man, I had the amazing opportunity. I have a little pizza joint right around the corner from my place. And I went in there one night and Brian May was eating pizza there. And I ended up meeting him and I was like, man, I did something on one of my records that you are a huge influence on. It's a guitar harmony thing. And I just want to say thank you. And I actually got to give him my record, and he was super cool. So Queen is a huge influence, and I'm like still a fanboy of all those bands because like the musicianship is so incredible. I can't believe I'm jealous that you got to hear Freddie Mercury's voice just in the atmosphere, man, because I got to ask you, what was that like? Because, I mean,
I'm getting goosebumps, I swear to you, just right now. And, you know, the thing is, I moved to Spain. I did not speak any languages, right?
Wow.
By age 10, I had English and Spanish, right? Barely. I still remember his words. I still remember the lyrics. So the ability for the human brain to remember something and say, kid, this is going to be important later on.
That's crazy. Yeah. And did you know of Queen at the time? Or
no, I just saw giant posters all over the city, over the town.
Crazy.
Yeah. My parents knew, right? They were in their 30s. My mom was in her 20s.
Wow. That is epic, dude.
Yeah.
So, and then what made you pick up the guitar? What made you pick up the instrument?
It was actually you know, no one's asked me these questions before. It's so profound.
This is why I do this the show. It's like it's musicians, you know.
I feel like it's a little fun fact.
Right over here, there's a little Freddie Mercury candle. I don't know if you can see it, but that's
no.
Right over here, there's a little Freddie Mercury candle.
Oh, there we go. I see it. Oh. Talk about burning at both ends, man. Poor guy.
I know.
The guitar. My mom's in this story too. Again, cool.
That's awesome.
I was 13, and I watched a movie called La Bamba, and it.
I love that movie, dude. That's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it broke my. The reason I'm kind of saying a little broke my heart, And I got a chance to go out with the Valance family for dinner one night.
What?
And we talked a lot. Yeah.
There were God, that's awesome.
Yeah, they still have his clothes and his T-shirts and everything at home. And, you know, they invited me up. I think every year they have concerts. Forgive me. It's north of Carmel or beside Carmel. It starts with M.
Monterey?
I think it's Monterey. So yeah, it was really cool. So that changed me. And then I saw Brian Setzer in the same movie. He played Eddie Cochran.
Yep.
In Town Blues. So I was into that for a long time.
That's amazing. That's amazing. Yeah,
so that's what made me pick up the guitar, and I taught myself for a good 10 years.
And so you were heavily influenced by the blues then? Because that's all blues based, rock and roll.
Blues, punk, but also I got the tail end of Guns N' Roses and Megadeth and Metallica before the, you know, Fade to Black album. And so there was a lot going on. There was a lot going on. We were very lucky, man. I don't feel kind of the youth of today are getting what we had.
I feel the same way. And it's, and I don't know if it's because, like, I'm like, am I being nostalgic? Am I, like, you know, thinking about, like, the best bands of, you know, but I really don't see any band that's huge today being this legendary act 30 years from now, like, you know, anybody from Michael Jackson to Guns N' Roses to Nirvana. I mean, those bands still haven't gone out of style. You know, that's what's crazy. Metallica, all those bands are still touring, still relevant. The AC/DC. Only difference is they're AC/DC.
Yeah.
And I just don't think that those bands are now making records like they used to make, where, you know, they were just like these heavy, heavy records that songwriting was amazing. The production was amazing. They're doing different things, but I don't think it's, I think there must've been like a renaissance when we were kind of like into those bands, because even like a band doing Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, nobody's doing a record like that now where it's like a two back-to-back saga that you release at different times. I mean, it's epic. All that stuff was so epic to grow up.
I remember the line of Tower Records.
Totally.
Yeah. And you have been playing longer than I have. So did you get experience with tape at all?
I actually just did my last record with tape. Okay. So I've gone backwards. When I was a kid, I started recording on the tape, just vocals, you know, singing in choirs and stuff. But when I got into recording, it was all computers. And so I did a ton of records on computers. And then I discovered my dream was always to work on analog tape. And I ended up finding a studio in North Hollywood around 2012. And I've done my last 3 or 4 records all on tape. And I do most of my work there.
Yeah.
And I think it's the greatest thing in the world because it just sounds better. Everything is just high fidelity. You have to make better decisions with less tracks. And it just becomes way more epic that way. So,
I mean, I listened to Revolutions. It was really phenomenal.
Thanks, man. Thank you.
I'm one of those blunt, I'm one of those blunt a-holes. I'm not sure if I can say that.
Oh, you can say it. You can say it.
Yeah. So, yeah. So, no, I was really floored, and I actually saw a lot of parallels the way we
record
and what you were doing. Yeah.
Yeah, man, we did, and there's not one edit on that record. Everybody played every note beginning to end, and it's all analog tape, mixed analog, recorded analog, no computers, like no automation, nothing. And it definitely gets you to sink your teeth into the music a little bit more and the production a little bit more. It also allowed me to experiment a little bit more with the mixes. Like, I let things hit the red. Like, I let things kind of like have some, you know, distortion. I allowed it because I liked it. And I was listening to all these records that I love, like the Beatles, Ray Charles. And I realized my favorite tracks by all these artists all have distortion. Every single one. Like, Zeppelin has distortion.
Oh, yeah.
Beatles, I Am the Walrus has distortion.
It sounded like really full. I was really impressed.
Yeah, I always am looking for ways to make music come alive. But tell me about your recording process and what you've done the last couple records and how you kind of think about making records.
Oh, wow. I'm going to lose my hair.
I'm already there, man. I'm already there.
I have a 3-year-old and an 8-year-old.
Wow.
I have an option of pounding them.
He made it. Awesome.
Having some issues here, guys.
That's all right. You made it, man. You made it. It's all good. Yeah, nice to meet you, Oscar.
Nice to meet you. It's a pleasure.
We're actually just talking about your records right now. So after Sepan answers this question real quick. Go ahead, Sepan.
Yeah. I don't want to mention this, but you look like you got a 10, and I just talked to you half an hour ago. Actually, Oscar, would be cool to talk about this. We were talking about the recording process. So I was talking about having a 3- and 8-year-old. you can pound them into shape. You can throw stuff at them to see what their personality gives.
Right.
See what sticks. Where
you can force them to act in a certain way. We can doll it up, right? So I think I have that perspective. Sometimes with the pop songs, we have to chisel things out. It's got to be this long, course, verse, chorus, or whatever arrangement we want.
Right.
Other things, we throw things at the song, and it rejects it or it accepts it.
Right.
And we're just kind of parents, you know, try soccer, try tennis, try, you know, see what you like, see what you're about. That works out. And I think it's a factor of surprise to us because we're not forcing things. We're not expecting the song to sound a certain way, right? Some songs take us 4 years to write. Some songs takes 45 minutes, half an hour.
I know both those feelings, and it's strange because you think you can control when a song is going to be finished. It never works out. It's like whenever somebody asks me, like when's the record coming out? I'm like, it'll let me know. You know what I mean? It'll decide when the record's done because you can't ever say, oh, it's going to be out in March or never been like, oh, I know it'll be done by this date and we're ready to, you know, release it for people to listen to on this date. It's like, I have to wait till it's actually in my hands to know if it can work like that. So do you guys write different parts together separately?
I forgot to answer one part of your last question.
Yeah, please.
It'd be sacrilege. This is a painting by Paul Whitehead. He did the early Genesis paintings, Van de Graaff Generator. So that's the cover of our album.
That's amazing.
And we would talk to him. We would say, this is what it's about. It's about giants. So then all of a sudden, Gandhi shows up, Isaac Newton shows up. There you go. You have a robot. You have people around Buddha. And I say this to Paul humorously. You can kind of see I'm tied down like Gulliver.
Yeah.
I said, you fucked up my life, man. we went out to a restaurant, and I told him about everything that was going on, mortgage, work. I was heavily involved with politics and business and music and marriage. And, you know, we had one kid out, one kid in the oven, right? And I looked at myself in that picture and I said, I need to change it. So divorce ensued, leaving my work ensued. It was hell. I'm still going through the tail end of it. But to let you know how we let things influence us, right?
Wow.
So, you know, sometimes we would sit and look at that picture and say, you know, we'll write a song about Sisyphus, which is the guy with the rock.
Right.
So
I love that you're influenced by like old folklore and like legends. Oscar, for your creative process, do you kind of think of words first? Do you think of licks on keys? Do you think of arrangements, influences? Are you learning songs? Tell me about your creative outlets.
It really varies, you know. A lot of times I like chord extensions. I like dissonance. Yeah. I like weird scales, you know. And so a lot of times it's working out maybe, you know, how to use this Hungarian scale in a pop context or something, you know?
Yeah.
And trying to make it, you know, to where it's not obvious, you know, maybe. But so working out a problem in a sense, you know, which is I know how sometimes some composers work as well. It's like figuring out a problem, you know, how do I how do I get this to work?
Well, it becomes like a it's like a language. It's like you're trying to like make phrases in the dialect, or, you know.
Right. Just, exactly. Yeah.
And do you are you heavily influenced by one style over another, or is it kind of like things are constantly picking at you and you're drawing inspiration from those at different times?
I think it's, you know, I grew up listening to a lot of progressive rock, you know, and that's
like
yes, Genesis.
Yeah.
Definitely. That's the Genesis is huge. Genesis and Yes, both huge for me. King Crimson.
Now with Peter Gabriel and without Peter Gabriel?
Both.
Oh, I love it. Because I'm a fan of both.
Yeah, I really love it. It's fantastic. I mean, the stuff on Duke and Abacab, and it's just incredible, you know. And then Marillion's a huge influence as well. But at the same time, you know, I'm constantly, you know, I'm kind of voracious. It's always, you know, I'm one of those guys that's, you know, on Apple Music says, you may also like, and I go down that rabbit hole endlessly. I find new stuff all the time, you know. So lately I've been, you know, picking up on Billie Eilish. She's fantastic. Future Islands. It Purity Ring, great band. You know, all sorts of influences. Listen to a lot of classical, modern, contemporary, I guess, art music.
Right.
You know, really it comes from all over the place, you know. And for me, I think it's more of a working out of a sound problem or like a sound idea or an intriguing scale or intriguing set of chords or intriguing dissonance or something. And I think it just really depends. It's not usually like lyrical ideas or anything. It's not usually like thematic, you know, content. And then like, for me, you know, it's more like let the music guide it and then follow that.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And then one thing that's interesting is that when we were working on the first album, and I had never really worked like this before because, you know, I had a whole bunch of demos from previous times, you know, just a mixed bag of stuff, you know, like.
Right. What did you record it on, DAT? Or was it like.
It's worse than that. It's 4-track.
Wow. I have some 4-track stuff. Yeah. I actually am still looking for some of my old 4-track stuff because sometimes those ideas are some of the best because they're so organic.
Exactly. Know? And it forced you to think like, okay, how am I going to do this? Right. Like, yeah. I've got maybe if I bounce down, you know, I've got 4, then 3, then 2, you know. And
my bulldog wants to say hello.
Oh, yeah. Hey.
He just got back.
What's his name?
His name's Otis.
Otis.
Oh. Hold on. There he is. Otis.
Otis Redding?
Yep, exactly.
Oh, nice. Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
He's got the gas side pointing at us, man. It's dangerous. You know,
he likes it. He always wants me to scratch his bum. But we found out that the reason he likes that is that's him saying that he trusts you very much. Yeah,
there you go.
Like, that's a bulldog thing. When a dog turns their back to you because that's the most vulnerable for them to be attacked or something.
That's true. If they
do that, then they're saying that they actually trust you wholeheartedly. But he trusts me a little too much because he always wants me to scratch his bum. But anyway, sorry. When he comes to say hello.
Oscar and I are going to hang out on Sunday. I want to show you how much I trust you.
Easy now. you were saying.
It was interesting because, you know, and I had, like, for example, the song on the first album, Requiem for the Living. That was originally a 4-track demo, and I had seen a film by Tom Tykwer, The Princess and the Warrior. He did Run Lola Run and some other films like that.
Yep.
And I just, like, you know, occasionally, like, I'll watch a film like that. I'm like, oh, cool. And, like, just kind of run upstairs and lay something down. Something does get, you know, opens the floodgate somehow.
Yeah.
And so the first part of that, of the Requiem song, was basically, after watching that film, you know, I just thought, oh, got to get this down, you know, on 4-track. And then Sapind listened to the demo. Amazing. We still had record tape players, you know. Mm-hmm. And you know, and then it became like kind of an MO for a little bit of how he would work on the first album, which is, you know, I had like bits and pieces and stuff. And he would go like, what if we did something like Goresh Keys Symphony Number 3.
Oh, that's awesome.
You know, and things like that. And I would, and a lot of times I would go like, no, that can't work. You know, and they're like, well, let me think about this. You know, like try to kind of like make it work. Like I said, like a kind of problem solving in a sense, you know. I took some orchestration classes and composition classes at UCLA,
okay,
and for the film scoring program. And I remember Bruce Reich, he was a great teacher there. He would talk about how that was his process too. It's like and how, you know, maybe Beethoven and stuff would be kind of like how can I make this idea work right. Long form,
right?
And you know, these,
but it always with classical music too, it's like it starts with a theme and then it's right. Like developed into kind of like an arrangement that right. Is constantly regurgitating that theme in either other instruments or other forms or inversions. So it's amazing when you can take your own little pieces and kind of elongate or kind of like finish them by right. Thinking them through in that kind of process. That's awesome.
Exactly, yeah. And so that's something I feel like lucky with, because both Sapan and I are very willing to go anywhere, really.
And how did you choose that goes?
Oh, that's interesting. Yeah, I was having a at the end of another musical project, and you know, my past MO was, you know, be with a band for like a few years, you know, you almost get somewhere, you know, you're talking to a record label, this and that, you've got a good following, and then things implode, and then back to square zero, you know.
Right.
And that happened many times with in my previous musical life, right? And so I was like, oh man, you know. And so I thought, okay, I'm gonna just see what's out there. And was looking at Music Connection, and Sapan had put an ad in there looking wow. for a collaborator. Yeah. And
did you put influences, Sapan? Did you put?
I did. You know, I come from Sonic Youth, Nirvana, Melvins, Jesus Lizard, Tool, Rage Against the Machine, some Canadian bands.
Oh, all those bands.
Yeah, so that's my route. And I'm afraid to tell you, to communicate this to you, because I'm worried you're gonna slap me. But I pretty much stopped listening to music.
What? Why?
2000. I just can't. I don't know. Like when the first record came out in 2007, I was a smartass. I was like, we invented something, right? And then all the other reviews came out: Pink Floyd, King Crimson, Genesis. Not only did I not invent anything, but they invented it 40 years ago, and a hell of a lot better than what we did.
Right.
You know, but yeah, I mean, I just don't listen to music.
Well, I'll tell you my little secret, okay? And I do this all the time. I listen to music voraciously. Like, just I have to get into as much music as possible. And then I kind of like let it stick and see what is still permeating in my head. And then if there's a song that I can't stop thinking about, I learn it. And when I learn it inside and out.
Mm-hmm.
And then I take it and I completely take all the ingredients of that song and I completely rearrange them and I add new chord changes or change the tempo or
right.
I completely disguise them so that yeah. people that you would never think are fans of the band, they'll come up to me and be like, I really love this song, and it just really speaks to me. And I'll be like, "Oh, you a Van Morrison fan?" They'll be like, "Yeah, how did you know?" And I'm like, "Oh, just a hunch, because I would take a Van Morrison song or
right.
some other thing." So, whatever makes it worthwhile for you to create, that's all that matters.
That
hits you out so you can make the music come from your imagination or make sense
right.
on your mind. That's cool, but it, you know, like I always feel like the best way to not sound like somebody is to completely understand them completely and then deviate, because then you know exactly how you're deviating, and it doesn't sound like something. It has ingredients of it and people can't place it. I mean, there's so many things on this record I just released that if you're not a musician, you're not going to get them all. You're just not. There's world influences. There's right. 90s. There's a song from every decade for the last like 60, 70 years on my last record. And some people get them and some people don't, you know? So I think it's just keep an open mind. Don't shut out music altogether because it will always influence you.
You know what you just did though? You made it feel not forced to me.
Right.
So it's actually you're embracing the song.
Oh, yeah. I think you have to.
I guess I'm feeling like an avalanche at me all the time. And I'm like, you know?
Right. Chip away one little part, man.
I like that. Actually, I think that's what Oscar does, too.
Yeah, I can tell you. I can tell with his keyboards alone. That's what he's doing. And Oscar, a little fun fact. You know, when I was 11 years old, I got an amazing opportunity to sing at the Grammy Awards with Mike and the Mechanics. Wow. Mike Rutherford from Genesis. He was the only one I knew from Genesis. I was a diehard fan of Genesis.
Yeah.
Bill Collins and Mike Rutherford. Because that was the time period they were doing all I Can't Dance, that whole period.
Yeah. So
he was the only one I knew in the band, and I was always like super starstruck.
Yeah.
And I still like listen to his guitar playing and think he's like one of the most underrated rhythm guitar players and hooky guitar players because everything he does is super musical. And I remember thinking that like watching him in rehearsals and stuff. But he's a legend, man. So like, I'm a diehard Genesis fan. I'm a diehard Peter Gabriel fan. Like, I love that you guys are creating music in that style because it is the antithesis of what is popular these days. But that's how it's always been. And then you have songs that make it into the limelight because they're so good. So I just love that you're going after it because that's what the music world needs more of. It needs more progressive rock. It needs more. You know, musicians that can play and arrange and write. Let's listen to something. What are we going to listen to first?
Goes by Gravity or Giants. Giants is the longer one.
Okay, you choose.
I would say Giants.
All right, let's play Giants. Here's Giants.
We're talking prog, so that's very proggy.
All right, let's do it.
Standing on the shoulders of giants, we were made to see the world for what it was. Walking in their footsteps, so compliant, we were listening to the words of love and trust. As the undertow pulls you down into the abyss where no one is ever shaking the sky, holding on to the reins, the great divide between memories and what remains, changing time. Torches changing off the guards as giants are brought down to serve. memories hazy and unreliant. Now lost for words as they return to dust. We want it all, the dust to survive. The erosion of time, retaining all the memories that make up our life. Carrying on with the legacy to live, to love, to be. And finally understanding our shared destiny. Shaking the sky, holding on to the reins, the great divide between memories and what remains. Changing time, passing torches, changing of the gods as giants are brought down.
Man, so good, so good.
Thanks.
Very early Peter Gabriel influence. I hear that a lot. I hear a little bit of Genesis, and I don't know if you guys know the band. I'm sure you guys do. Jellyfish. Do you know Jellyfish?
Oh, yeah. Sure.
I definitely hear some Jellyfish. You have some Peter Gabriel Jellyfish, man.
Nice.
You have some Peter Gabriel Genesis and Jellyfish. All kind of smeared in there. I like it, but it's got its own thing too. So tell me a little bit. Tell me a little bit how that song came about.
Monsieur, that is yours.
That was an interesting one. You know, it started musically, so it was that left hand piano ostinato there,
right?
And you know, I tend to gravitate towards nines and elevens and stuff on the melodies. And, you know, it was like a mood thing, right? And at the time, my dad was going through kind of the later stages of Alzheimer's.
Oh,
and sorry. Then, yeah. And then, so, you know, that, you know, music sort of.
It's therapy.
It's an exorcism in certain ways, you know. And so that one, I actually did start to write some lyrics. So, you know, it came musically first, but then, you know, I got a theme, basically. And it was sort of the angle of, you know, as I was, as my dad was kind of, you know, they lose a lot of the shorter term memories. And then they seem to kind of revert sometimes to being children almost, right? Yeah. And so my dad would ask me sometimes, are you, because, you know, I was helping take care of him quite a bit. And he would ask me sometimes, are you my dad? You know, I say, wow. No, you're my dad. You know?
Wow.
And so it was interesting, you know, to like kind of do that full circle thing there. And I remember, and I had an image in my head of, you know, my dad used to have some race horses. And I remember talking to somebody about how, and my dad always dressed very, elegantly, let's say, always a suit, hat, you know, kind of looked like Elliot Ness, I guess, that era, you know. And I remember going to the stables where the horses were, and then just everything looked so gigantic, right? The horse was like 40 feet high. My dad was 40 feet high.
Like a dinosaur.
Yeah. So, and then I remember like that perspective, and it just seemed like so like, you know, what are they even talking about? You know, yeah, larger than life, you know, like I can't even imagine what they're talking about, or, you know. And then, so this whole idea of someone being a giant, and then some to you like, so not a literal giant, but you know, could be anybody who's a giant to you in your life. It was that kind of angle, and sort of the reversal of the roles, you know. And then once we started meeting with Billy and Paul, and with Paul we would meet at this Indian restaurant in downtown LA. It's It's in the first floor of it's an old Art Deco hotel. I forget the name of it. But so we would have these long lunches and just discuss everything under the sun. And we would talk about everything from Gandhi to Genesis. Well, obviously, a lot of talk about Genesis because I was, oh, Paul, what about this and that? You know, like, because he was there, you know?
Right.
And then, you know, I remember at one point we kind of like decided, especially because Billy was going to be singing it, and it was maybe, you know, hard for him to get into my point of view emotionally. So we kind of broadened it and we started talking about the actual mythical giants, you know, from Greek myth and the clash of the titans and the, and the giants, you know, and so a lot of themes came, you know, a lot of themes that I had already kind of explored, you know, like the Nemesine, the river of memory. And it was just sort of interesting, you know, to kind of put this kind of epic framework around this story that was actually really personal and then kind of expand it out. And but like I said, you know, like it became a little bit more universal as we started collaborating, obviously, on the lyrics, you know.
You know, on my side, I'm happy we did, because a lot of things happened. You know, we talked about divorce. This album was actually done, finished. We mastered it, I think, February 2015, Oscar? Or 16?
Yeah, 16, I think. Yeah. 16.
Then it was divorce. It was like, so this didn't get released for about 4 years. If I'm like, yeah, there you go. My mouth is right. So by that time, no one's heard the music, including ourselves, right? And then now we have a certain type of president. We have COVID. We have all these things, and it's like, wow, not that our stuff was prophetic, but the fact that, because we took themes from the ancient world, what survived? Zeus was kind of a fad,
right?
Way, but love, loss, war, what we believe in, and the album cover is very tribal, and look what's happened, right? It just happened to be a permutation of the things we were scared of that we discussed.
Well, art imitates life, as they say, right?
Yeah. Yeah.
That's
true. And this, you know, and I prefer music that way, to be your companion, because I love the Killers, but that only lasts 2 weeks for me. Right. But I still listen to The Wall. I still listen to a lot of the classics.
That's, you know, it's funny when you guys are talking about influences and things, like I'm listening to, I always have my finger on the pulse for everything that's happening now. But when it comes to like learning music, like I just got the guitar sound I got this new pedal board, and I got the guitar sound for David Gilmour on Breathe for Dark Side of the Moon. Because it's like I've been looking for that univibe, that funky univibe sound that he's got, and I finally got it. It's like a Hendrix-y sound. But in doing these you know, experimentations with combinations of pedals, it was like finding gold, you know, like, and that record was made, you know, 50 years ago.
Yeah.
You know, so I'm going backwards and I still find this like gold mine in Pink Floyd Hendrix. Like, it never gets old. And I just feel like, you're right. Like, a lot of the music that's coming out now, I just don't see it's going to be like this 20-year relationship that people are going to come back to 20 years from now, because it's just not as well built. So I love that you still come back to the Pink Floyds and the Genesis and all those styles.
I'm evolving with the music. I'm maturing to it, right?
Right.
So right now I'm 45. I'm feeling forgiveness coming in, more seeping through. I'm not so much about glory, the Wall Street glory. I'm more focused on my kids.
Yep.
And doing the best I can to leave whatever I can so somebody can pick it up and do something hopefully positive with it, right?
Yeah.
And so when you listen to songs like Mother by Pink Floyd, or, you know, it's just universal, and you grow with it. And since your perspective is different, you listen to things differently.
But you can tell, like, there's a lot of thought process in your music, because it comes from that, it's woven from the same cloth. You know, it's got like layers that you can listen to it and hear it on one layer where it's like, oh, okay, I'm getting the melody. But then it's like, as you listen to all these like mythical kind of references or these metaphors and the lyrics or even what's going on in the music, you know there's something more powerful. That's what's so great. I mean, that's why they call it progressive rock, because it is progressive, you know, on so many levels. Let's play something else. What are we playing next?
So we got Goes by Gravity, or if you really want to get depressed, it's Witness the End of the World.
We'll choose
Witness the End of the World. It features Durga McBroom from Pink Floyd.
Awesome.
On lead vocals.
All right, here it comes.
Is we covered with gold, dancing in all the ruins we sold, monuments to invention and pride, now in decay the future's decided. In memory of the dreams that were lost, our footprints etched in dust, traveling down an uncertain path, our empires covered in rust, everything we once knew winding down. Witness the end of the world, the center of our universe under. Witness the end of the
love it. So tell me why such a dark and heavy tune? I mean, there's so many layers to this.
Why?
I want to get to the grits.
You know, what's interesting is at the time I wrote like a series of like four or five waltzes. Just got sort of, I don't know, I got into waltz mode for some reason. Yeah, I was, Sapan had listened to one waltz that was built on chords, built on fourths entirely, which we still might do something with at some point. Again, going back to, you know, trying to work out problems, you know. So it's kind of quartal harmony, but, you know, for whatever reason, we gravitated to this one. We tend to gravitate to melancholy kind of stuff.
I love that kind of music. It gets so dreamy and dreary. It's like two of my favorite combinations of sounds.
Yeah.
Because it just becomes like hypnotic at that point. You know, it's like it transports you to a different place.
Yeah, exactly. And the original lyric was actually, "It's not the end of the world."
Oh, okay.
Which is, you know, it was a little bit of tongue-in-cheek, you know, look at how something can be feel like the end of the world for somebody, that, and then someone goes like, "Oh, Jesus, dude, come on, it's not the end of the world." You know, to somebody else, it's nothing, you know.
And then what changed? You were like, "No, let's make it dark. Let's go dark."
Right. It actually got, yeah, it made it a lot darker in a way, you know. But again,
isn't it funny? Like two word changes in that changed the whole. It's not the end of the world. To witness the end of the world, you know, it's like, whoa, what? In two different phrases. It's like crazy, you know.
Exactly. That's crazy. Yeah.
That's awesome.
It was interesting because, you know, when we collaborate with Billy too, one of the things, what a great collaborator he is, you know,
Billy Sherwood. Billy.
Yeah, Billy Sherwood from Yes, of course. And for those the few people out there that don't know, Billy Sherwood's the bass player in Yes, handpicked by Chris Squire as his successor, and what shoes to fill, right? And he's doing it really admirably. I mean, well, he's such a great, you know, Chris Squire, obviously one of the best bass players of all time. Billy's really ably filling in those shoes, you know, and I've got to say, and it's not just because it's our album, but Billy's bass work on our album is
it's not great.
It's so great, you know. And but he's such a great collaborator. You know, Sapan and I kind of call him. I don't know. It's just like I mentioned one time that it's like he just kind of pops the lid off his head and just music just flows out. You know.
You know what? I find that it's like it's usually the most humble musicians that you come across.
Yeah.
Maybe they realize like how vast music is. Those are the ones that, cause I've had the same experiences with really heavy hitters.
Yeah.
As musicians. And there's never a lack of an idea or an approach. And it's like when it's relentless and it's like unstoppable, only good things can come from that. So
yes,
you know, I was thinking to myself, what the biggest challenge to creativity was. I was having this conversation with myself on the highway. This is how things roll in the head.
This is every day for me, man. So go ahead.
I was like, you know what? The best thing is to get the hell out of your own way, right? Billy's done that. It's almost like he jumps on a wave and surfs it. Doesn't give a shit. Whatever it is, there it is, right?
Well, and he gets every reference too, you know. So it's like, are you going for kind of a Duke thing here, you know? It's like, oh yeah, you know? And it's liberating because he knows, you know, like where you're trying to go with things, you know.
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of, you give him a little direction and he's able to fly with it, you know. And
that's
kind of what you want when you're collaborating with anybody, even the two of you. It's like,
there
seems to be like a symbiotic connection between how your ideas flow together. Do you ever have a time when it doesn't work? When you're like, nah, you're not feeling this idea between just the two of you?
Well, I have this thing like where Sapan will kind of look over at me, and this happens, you know, whether it's just me and him or me and him and Billy. He go, oh, he's getting mad, right? It's just because I'll get this certain look where it's like, and really I'm just kind of like thinking like, how could we make that work, right? But
that's not the look we get. Have you seen Office?
The look of you're taking my idea and you're turning it into something I don't want it to.
Have you seen Office? Have you seen the Office Space?
Oh yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, it's classic.
I call him the stapler guy. He's like, no.
Dietrich Bader was a guest on our show. Dietrich Bader, you know, the guy who's the neighbor. He actually was a guest on our show.
That's awesome.
That movie. Yeah, and I was actually, so excited.
Actually, have a like, red stapler here.
That's crazy, dude. That's awesome. That's awesome.
Don't touch my stapler.
I mean, that's like one of the parts of creativity. It's like you don't know where it's going to lead. And that's what makes it's like, I think part of my favorite moments in music is when I kind of don't know where it's going to go and it goes somewhere and it's better than where I could have led it myself, you know? So it's definitely like, it is part of that getting it out of the way, getting yourself out of the way so that things flow, but also getting some kind of direction that still is close to resembling what you want it to be. You know what I mean?
Right. You're in that lane, but not necessarily, and you might take a little, you know, little left at the fork, right? Instead of a right.
Do you guys play live at all, or do you just make records? Like, how do you perform these arrangements?
I manned up finally after 17 years, and I decided to play live. So we're actually working on our first live show.
That's awesome.
Yeah. And I owe it to Oscar and Billy, and you know, I want the kids to see Dad before it all goes white.
Honestly, that's like, there's two sides of this, and it's performing and making records.
Yeah.
You need both. You just need both because it's like I road test songs when I know I'm going to make a record. I'm usually one or two records ahead of what most people are going to hear at the time. Like, I already know what I'm doing for my next project, and I'm starting that together, which is why I built this new pedal board. But it's like, if I don't road test things, it's like, you don't get that scope of like, okay, is this hitting? Is this?
Yeah.
You know, once it's recorded and you play it for people, it's done.
Yeah.
But if you road test a new song and you hear that response from the live audience in the moment, you're going to get a very honest response. It's either going to be like, oh my God, that's awesome, or oh my God, I don't get it. And then, you know, it's about you rearranging it so that it can be what it is. Then there's the studio aspect where it's like you're trying to capture that performance.
Yeah, right.
It's like if you are able to do that on both sides, I find it to be exhilarating, that quest.
I found like the studio stuff is cool, but it does not. And I'm going to correct myself because I was wrong initially. I thought that you could be a good musician just playing at home. And the fact is, you know, I'm sitting down, I'm playing, I'm recording, I can stop and play anytime I want. But when you're standing up and playing and there's no going back, my chops are a lot better. I'm a lot more confident.
Right.
You know? And I don't mean that on the overconfident side. I mean, I'm trying to reach the middle, you know, like where I'm not bashing myself all the time.
Yep.
So they're actually really important to each other.
And I also think there's like a very beautiful thing that happens in a rehearsal. You know, like there's like this, you're trying to, you know, and it's kind of a funny thing. You're all trying to impress each other, but you're doing it in a way that's like giving confidence in each other as a unit.
Yeah.
There's something that's powerful that comes from all of that.
Yeah.
Are you making new records? Are you're working on a new live show? Where can we see you guys play? Where can we hear the newest music that you guys are about to release? Where can people find you is what I'm asking.
Oh, well, our record, Giants, is actually on our store. It's daysbetweenstations.com. Hold on. Can I get it?
Yeah, I love it.
The new the vinyl edition. It was delayed a bit by the pandemic, but
oh, that's awesome!
Splatter vinyl.
Vinyl. Number 11 is yours, sir. So
that's awesome.
So daysbetweenstations.com, and then the live show will probably be Mayish or early June. I think May. We're working on album number 4. And we're working on some film music, a documentary of an artist by the name of Jean-Paul Baudier. He's a French artist who lives in Berkeley, California. And he just goes to the desert, paints actual landscapes. It's incredible to see. Wow. So, it's just gorgeous stuff. And then we're going to re-release the debut on vinyl. And that's it. We're getting ready to...
Awesome. And, you know, speaking of the desert, we recently went out to the desert to El Mirage Dry Desert Lakebed. And we filmed a video for Witness the End of the World.
Amazing.
With Durga McBroom. She's fantastic. She's just great presence, you know. And so we've got that coming out soon. What else?
And the rehearsal band, we're rehearsing with Billy and Jennifer Joe Oberle.
Yeah, she's fantastic musicians.
And believe me, playing in my room all my life, and all of a sudden I show up and Billy Sherwood and Jennifer are there, no messing around, you know. So they're
awesome.
super team.
They're great. They're fantastic.
You guys have been wonderful guests, and man, I love the sound. I love the songs. I love the album. I love it all, man. We got to get you guys back when you guys do your next live show, your next album release. We'd love to have you back.
We'd love to come back.
Yeah, you guys are tremendous musicians, tremendous collaborators. I hope you never stop making music. And yeah, man, Days Between Stations. Tell me real quick, one last question. How did you come up with the name?
Ah, that's an interesting one. Back in the early 90s, I think, I was in a used bookstore and found this book by a LA writer named Steve Erickson, Days Between Stations. It was his first novel. And I just fell in love with his writing. I read everything he had done, Rubicon Beach. He did one Leap Year, which was a nonfiction about the 88 elections. Tours of the Black Clock, great writer. He used to write for the LA Weekly as well.
Okay.
And then that was just a really impactful like book for me.
It's like reading Dali almost.
That's crazy.
Yeah, and really like hops from genre to genre. yeah, it's sort of progressive in that sense. You know, he's in multiple genres in that book, and so when we were coming up with a name for the project, that's one of the names I suggested.
It kind of hit home for me. It felt like we were doing a pilgrimage in life, you know? And someone always asked me, what was the lesson? And the answer to me is, it's there's always another lesson, right? So that's really what it is.
What a perfect way to end our interview. That's awesome, gentlemen.
Thank you so much.
Terrific people, terrific musicians. Never stop. Keep on pushing forward.
And you too, man. You too.
You guys are inspirational. So thank you, Nikki.
My saxophonist.
We'll have to do some music together too, man.
That
would
be fantastic. I was going to suggest that. Let's do it.
I'm always the first to suggest. No, man. I love working with great musicians. So
it'd be an honor, man. Time.
Ladies and gentlemen, Days Between Stations, pick up their records. You can find them online. Giants, you can find them. They're music giants, so just grab their stuff. And on behalf of Ronen, myself, Stepan, and Oscar, we just say thank you for tuning in, and we'll see you guys next week. Thank you, Stepan and Oscar.
Thank you very much.
We'll talk to you guys soon, okay? We'll see you guys soon.
Thank you for your time.
Awesome. Thank you.
Cheers, guys.
Cheers. Thanks.